Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am in Leviticus chapter 24. We're going to do the whole chapter in this session, verses 1 through 23. We will talk about furniture in the holy place. We'll talk about blasphemy against the name of God, and we'll talk about the legal principle eye for an eye, the lex talionis. Those three topics seem to be somewhat unrelated. I'll try to tie the last two topics together when we get there, but so this is somewhat miscellaneous. Our context is this. In the previous chapter, the last half of the chapter, 23, we discussed certain feasts of the Lord, namely the Tishri festivals, Tishri 1, Feast of Trumpets, Rosh Hashanah, Tishri 10, Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur, and then the Feast of Booths, the Feast of Tabernacles, Tishri 15 through Tishri 21. So here we are now in Leviticus 24. We'll start with verse 1 and go through verse 4. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, command the sons of Israel that they bring to you clear oil from beaten olives for the light, to make a lamp burn continually. Now this light is talking about the seven-branch candlestick in the holy place. Verse 3, outside the veil of testimony in the tent of meeting, Aaron shall keep it in order from evening to morning before the Lord continually. It shall be a perpetual statute throughout your generations. And when it says Aaron will do this, it means Aaron's going to be in charge of it. Of course, his priests are going to be actually doing it. Verse 4, he shall keep the lamps in order on the pure gold lampstand before the Lord continually. All right, now we see that the oil that's going to feed those seven lamps, it's got to be clear oil. King James has pure oil. And this is a good symbolism, of course, because everything about God's worship should be pure, not mixed with uncleanness, or symbolically not mixed with sin. Now, these seven lamps in the lampstand were to burn continually. Verse 2 says, also verse 4 repeats that, continually. Why do the lamps have to burn continually? Well, if the light ever went out, it would be totally dark in the tabernacle. There were no windows. And it would also be inappropriate where God is. There's always light. God's light never goes out, as well as impractical, because if it was totally dark in there, the priest couldn't minister. They couldn't change out the wicks and trim the wicks, add oil to the lamps. Couldn't do that because it would be totally dark. So light in the holy place always never went dark. Now, this requirement for clear beaten oil is also mentioned in Exodus 27, verses 20 and 21. You shall charge the sons of Israel, God tells Moses, that they bring you clear oil, there's clear again, a pure oil, of beaten olives for the light, to make a lamp burn continually. In the tent of meeting, outside the veil which is before the testimony, Aaron and his sons shall keep it in order from evening to morning before the Lord. It shall be a perpetual statute throughout the generations for the sons of Israel. Now, you can see there, that's basically just a complete restatement of the law in Exodus, no difference that I can see. This oil was provided at public expense, as John Gill says. Verse 3, where these lamps are said to be outside the veil of testimony. What is the veil of testimony? That's the veil with the four columns separating the holy place, the 10 by 20 by 10 cubit holy place, from the 10 by 10 by 10 holy place where the Ark of the Covenant was. There's a veil between those two. We talked about that in Exodus. Why is it called the veil of testimony? Because the testimony was the Ten Commandments, and the Ten Commandments were in the Ark of the Covenant, and the Ark of Covenant was in the Holy of Holies. So the veil veiled one from entering into where the law was, where the testimony was. Inside the tent of meeting, that's the tabernacle. Now, there was originally a tent of meeting, a temporary tent of meeting, where Moses met God before the tabernacle was built, but after the tabernacle was built, the name was transferred to the tabernacle. Why was it called that? Because that's where God met Moses all the time. We read in Exodus 29:42, it shall be a continual burnt offering throughout your generations at the doorway of the tent of meeting before the Lord, where I will meet with you to speak to you there. So that's why it's called the tent of meeting, because God met with Moses there. And his successors also, Exodus 25:22, there I will meet with you. And from above the mercy seat, from between the two cherubim, which are upon the ark of the testimony, I will speak to you about all that I will give you in commandment for the sons of Israel. So apparently Moses stood at the doorway. God is, of course, enshrined between the cherubim above the ark and the Holy of Holies. And God let Moses hear what he had to say through the length of the tabernacle. At least that's the way I take it. By the way, tent of meeting sounds like a place of meeting, like a place where you meet for worship, like the meeting house. That's not what it meant. God did the meeting, not the people. And he did it by appointment only, not by accident. We move now to verse 5, and we'll read verses 5 through 9. of Leviticus 24. Then you shall take fine flour and bake 12 cakes with it. 2/10 of an ephah shall be in each cake. 2/10 of an ephah is 4 quarts. You shall set them in 2 rows, 6 to a row, on the pure gold table before the Lord. Now this is the table on the north side of the holy place, the 10 by 10 by 20, 10 by 20 by 10 room, that the antechamber, if you will, to the holy of holies. This is the holy place. And the gold table is there, and the bread of the presence is put on that table. Verse 7, you shall put pure frankincense on or near each row. Holman Christian Study Bible has near. New American Standard has on. You shall put pure frankincense on or near each row, that it may be a memorial portion for the bread, even an offering by fire to the Lord. The frankincense is an offering by fire, not the bread. Verse 8, every Sabbath day he shall set it in order before the Lord continually. It is an everlasting covenant for the sons of Israel. It shall be for Aaron and his sons, and they shall eat it in a holy place, for it is most holy to him from the Lord's offerings by fire, his portion forever. Well, let's start with verse 5. There are going to be 12 cakes or 12 loaves. Why 12? Because each loaf represented a gift from each of the 12 tribes. Now, these 12 cakes were also called the bread of the presence, which is my favorite term for it, Exodus 25:30. You shall set the bread of the presence on the table before me at all times, continually. Now, that bread of the presence, traditionally, by the King James Version, has been translated showbread. I like bread of the presence better, because showbread, I mean, what does that mean? Here's why it's called bread of the presence, because presence refers to the presence of God himself. So the bread of the presence means this is bread before the presence of God. Where was God? Well, he's in the Holy of Holies. And where is this bread? In the face of God. Presence means face, in the face of. So the bread is in the presence of God because the bread is right outside the doorway of the Holy of Holies, where God is. Now, that word presence is often used to refer to the presence of God himself. Exodus 33:14-15. And he said, my presence shall go with you, and I will give you rest. Then he said to him, if your presence does not go with us, do not lead us up from here. God talking to Moses. And God mentions himself as being somewhere as his presence. Isaiah 63:9. In all their afflictions he was afflicted, and the angel of his presence saved them. So, the bread is placed before the presence of the face of God, as Adam Clark says. That's where I got the idea from, actually. From Adam Clark, God is present in the Holy of Holies. The bread is therefore in the presence of God because it's right outside that veil of the testimony, the second veil, the inner veil. Now, verse 7 says, well, before we go to verse 7, let's talk about the 12 cakes, how they were arranged. Well, there was 12 loaves, one for each tribe, as I said, 2 rows of 6 each, as Adam Clark said. Verse 6 says that you shall set them in 2 rows, 6 to a row. So we got 2 rows, whether they are vertically laid out on that golden table or horizontally. It doesn't say. It seems to me would make more sense to lay them out horizontally because there's more room given the shape of the table. But at any rate, there were 2 rows, and near or on these 2 rows was frankincense. Now, how was that handled? Well, Adam Clark says that at the top of each row was a golden dish in which frankincense was burned, and that frankincense was burned every week, every Sabbath, when the loaves were changed out. The loaves were changed out every Sabbath, according to Gill. I don't know if he gets that from the rabbis or from the scripture. Probably gets it from the scripture, because verse 8 says, every Sabbath day he shall set it in order. So every Sabbath they changed it out, and they would relight the incense at the same time, the frankincense. And, of course, frankincense is sweet-smelling. The idea this is pleasing, a pleasing aroma to the Lord. Now, what is the symbolism, not of the frankincense, but of the bread itself? And NIV Study Bible suggests that Israel is consecrated to God, the fruit of her labors. The harvest was made into bread, and here it is, God will give it unto you. Okay, I go with that. How about this idea? Option number 2, God is the bread of life, spiritually, for the Israelites. God feeds the Israelites, so here's bread symbolizing that. John Gill says that God physically provides bread for the Israelites, and so what is a symbol of. Thank you, God, for feeding us physically. I say spiritually, he says physically, could be both. Option number 4, the bread is a symbol of communion between God and the Israelites because the priest ate the bread after they changed it out every Saturday. So the priest, representing the people, ate the bread as a guest of God, so there's communion. I like Adam Clark's view. Quote, it is more difficult to ascertain the use of these, or what they represented, than almost any other emblem in the whole Jewish economy. Many have conjectured their meaning, and I feel no disposition to increase their number by any addition of my own. In other words, Adam Clark punts. I much prefer when it's fourth down to take the ball and run and take a chance that you might get the first down. I think it's talking about the bread of life. The God is the bread of life for the Israelites, and that's why they put the bread on the bread of the that's why they put the bread of the presence on that golden table before the Holy of Holies, before the Ark of the Covenant. Now, I don't know if I mentioned this, but this golden table was put at the north side of the holy place. We know that from Exodus, as I've already talked about when we went through Exodus and talked about all the layout of the furniture. Verse 7 says this frankincense that's put near each row, I'm going to assume in a golden bowl at the end of each row or at the top of each row, not on top of it. By the way, John Gill quotes somebody as saying that these two rows of six loaves were stacked. Each row was really a column of six bread stacked up. I don't think so, but I just mentioned that as a possible but slim possibility as to how this bread was laid out. So the frankincense is said to be an offering by fire. Verse 8, every Sabbath day, the priests set it in order. They change the bread out when the bread gets stale. We don't have stale bread before the Lord, obviously. The priests do this continually. In other words, every Sabbath, we never let the bread go stale. It is an everlasting covenant. That means as long as the Old Testament order was in operation, which ceased when Jesus came and died on the cross. It is an everlasting covenant for the sons of Israel. Before I get to that, let's look at this continually again. I said the priest changed out the bread every Sabbath, but here's a way that makes it even a way of expressing this that makes it even more vivid. At the same time one priest was taking away the old bread, another priest is putting on the new bread. In other words, we're not going to let that table stay empty for a second. Now, the sons of Israel are mentioned in verse 8. It's a covenant for the sons of Israel, which means the sons of Israel had a part of that covenant of providing the showbread. And so this showbread was giving it public expense, maybe by donations to the tabernacle, I suppose. And of course, everlasting means as long as the Old Testament order is in order, is in existence. Now, verse 9, it shall be for Aaron and his sons. They shall eat it in a holy place. That would be the courtyard, for it is most holy to him from the Lord's offerings by fire, his portions forever. Now, when you see that phrase, holy place, one is tempted to think, oh, that's the 10 by 10 by 20 room where the bread of the presence and the seven branch candlestick is. No, this is not a capital H, capital P holy place. This is a holy place, means the courtyard, which is mentioned a lot of times in Leviticus as a holy place where the priests had to eat things, for example, the sin offerings. So we go now to Leviticus 24, 10 through 12. Now, the son of an Israelite, we're changing subjects here at verse 10, from the furniture of the holy place. Now we're going to talk about blasphemy. Leviticus 24, verses 10 through 12. Now the son of an Israelite woman, whose father was an Egyptian, went out among the sons of Israel, and the Israelite woman's son and a man of Israel struggled with each other in the camp. The son of the Israelite woman blasphemed the name and cursed. The name there is talking about the name of God. So they brought him to Moses. Now his mother's name was Shelomith, the daughter of Dibri of the tribe of Dan. They put him in custody so that the command of the Lord might be made clear to them. Now this son of an Israelite woman, I'm going to call him a half-breed from now on, might be a little pejorative, but it's just easier to refer to him so we don't get confused about who is who here. His father was Egyptian, his mother was Deborah Shelomith, the Israelite woman. That made the blasphemer an alien, as the NIV Study Bible. I guess that's because citizenship passed through the father's side, and his father was an Egyptian, so he was not considered a native-born Jew. Of course, aliens were just as subject to the law as Israelites, as the NIV Study Bible points out, as we'll see right here in about 10 verses, Leviticus 24, 22. There shall be one standard for you. It shall be for the stranger as well as the native, for I am the Lord your God. This is a repeat of Exodus 12, 49. The same law shall apply to the native as to the stranger who sojourns among you. Now, they weren't required to be circumcised. It's just like a proselyte of the gate. As somebody who is has a green card, he's a temporary resident alien, he's living there, maybe doing business or whatever. In this case, he's married to a Jewish woman, but he's not a citizen. Now, he had to obey the basic laws. He had to follow the Ten Commandments. He can't blaspheme God, for example, but he wasn't required to be circumcised. Now, if he's going to be not just a temporary green card resident alien, but he's going to get citizenship, then he would be a proselyte of righteousness, and he would be required to be circumcised. Now, I don't know which one this guy was, but I suspect it's a green card temporary resident alien, a proselyte of the gate. because the judges here had to decide, what are we going to do with this guy? He's not really an Israelite. But then in verse 22, the law is going to say, yep, we're going to enforce the law of the Israelite just as well on the alien, just as well as we will on native Israelites. And so that's why I think this guy is not a true Israelite. He's not a proselyte of righteousness. That's just my reasoning here. I hope it's right. This guy was probably, this half-breed, was probably one of the mixed multitude that left Egypt. Either he was one of the mixed multitude or his father was. In Exodus 12:38, we read this, a mixed multitude also went up with them, that's on the Exodus, along with flocks and herds, a very large number of livestock. A mixed multitude, that means maybe Hebrew, Egyptian slaves wanted to leave with the Hebrew slaves, or maybe in this case, a Hebrew man had married, an Egyptian man had married a Hebrew slave, and so he wanted to go. So we had some Egyptians, not just pure Israelites. We had a mixed multitude, it says, which sounds like a lot of people left on the Exodus with the Jews, and that's something we often don't take notice of. So the half-breed son of Shelomith might be considered the mixed multitude. Let's say his father's still there in the camp. The father might have stayed behind in Egypt, but still he impregnated Shelomith with the half-breed, and so then the half-breed would be of the mixed multitude. If the father came along, well, then he would be one of the mixed multitude as well. But the point is, the guy was an alien. He wasn't a native Jew. Now, he struggled with a man of Israel, a Jewish guy. They struggled. Now, there's some speculation as to what the fight was about. Speculation number one, the half-breed son could have reviled the showbread and the oil, provoking a response from the man of Israel. How dare you make fun of the bread of the presence and the oil in the lamp? And Gil is trying to find some context here between the first few verses of this chapter of Leviticus, which talks about the showbread and the oil and this fight and this blasphemy of the name. What's the connection? Well, that might be the connection. To be honest with you, though, I don't know why in the world the half-breed son would get all worked up over the showbread and the oil to curse it. Speculation number two, the half-breed son could have claimed a place in Dan to fix his tent, in other words, to place his residence. Hey, my mother's from the tribe of Dan, so I want to have a line of inheritance in the tribe of Dan. Remember, the inheritance passed through the father, it's not through the mother, and so the half-breed son might be claiming an inheritance through his mother instead of his father. And the Israelite, the Jewish guy, might have said, you can't do that. The right of inheritance has to go through the father, and your father's an Egyptian, so you can't inherit in Dan. And then a fight starts. That's speculation number two. That's pretty good speculation. Good as any, I guess. Here's speculation number three. This is my speculation. The Israelite may have mocked the half-breed as a half-breed. He might have said, you're just a mongrel. You're just, kind of a racial epithet. And so, people get upset about that kind of thing. I mean, half-breed, the name half-breed, which I'm using here, is very pejorative. I just use it so we can remember who this guy was a little bit better, but it's pejorative. And so somebody might have said, hey, you half-breed, and then a fight started. It doesn't really matter. There was a fight. And in the middle of the fight, the half-breed gets angry and he blasphemes God. Verse 11. Now, this was a violation of one of the Ten Commandments, Exodus 20, verse 7. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not leave him unpunished who take his name in vain. Now, taking God's name in vain means you take it for a non-serious purpose. For example, I swear by God I'll pay you this loan back, when you actually don't intend to pay it back. That's taking God's name in vain. Or what if you just say, oh my God, I don't feel good today. Well, you've taken the name of God used it in a very light and rash way, and so you've taken the name of God in vain. Now, if you actually use the name of God to curse somebody, that's really taking the name of God in vain, not for the purpose for which the name of God was intended, to curse somebody with God's power and his majestic name. So we all kind of have a feel for taking God's name in vain. And I tell you, when you look on the internet and see OMG all the time, oh my God, all the movies, oh my God. When I was in China, the Chinese have a very mild oath called Tiana, Tian, which means heaven. And so they're saying, my heavens. Well, that's even in English. It's mild. But somehow the English translation got over there as, oh my God. So they all go around, these innocent little Chinese college students, oh my God, oh my God. I said, please don't do that. I've told several Chinese Christians, don't do that. Don't take the name of God in vain. They don't mean to. I mean, it's just the way it was translated to them. Second language doesn't have quite the same impact as the first. But at any rate, during the fight or either after the fight, after a trial in which the son lost his case against the Israelite son, then he might have cursed God in vain. If so, that would be a worse blasphemy than if it occurred during the fight, because if it occurred during the fight, the son could say, well, you know, I just lost my temper in the heat of the moment. But if you lose after a trial, if you blaspheme God after a lost trial, you are premeditatingly taking God's name in vain. It doesn't really matter whether it's in the heat of passion or whether it was intentional. You blaspheme God, and oh, what are we going to do with you? They brought the half-breed to Moses and put him in custody so that they could see what God's going to do with this guy. Now, this case was brought all the way to the top to Moses. It didn't go to an inferior hearing. You remember Jethro said, hey, Moses, you're killing yourself. You need to divide the tribes up into some subsidiary jurisdictions and let the lower court cases be heard by other people and just let appeals come to you. But this one went straight to Moses. And that's probably because these judges didn't know how to deal with this. Now, they knew that blasphemy and cursing was a terrible crime. And in fact, they knew from Exodus 27, you shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. They knew about that law. And that law said the one who does that will not be unpunished. Doesn't say what the punishment is. So they knew that there was a punishment, but another place in the law, Exodus 21:17, tells us what the punishment is to be, or at least you could reason from this verse. Exodus 21:17 says, he who curses his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. Well, if you get capital punishment for cursing your father or mother, a fortiori, you're going to get capital punishment for cursing God. So maybe the elders hadn't quite come to that reasoning yet. Maybe they hadn't seen it immediately. If they had, they knew the guy had to be executed. They knew that he had blasphemed. No question about that. That's why they took him to court. The factual situation was clear. He had blasphemed the name. But then they had to decide, well, what are we going to give him as punishment? Well, maybe some of them had figured, well, the punishment should be death. But then they had another problem they had to deal with. What kind of death? Stoning, burning, a punishment worse than stoning, beheaded, drawn and quartered, you know, there's lots of possibilities. Some people say that the only thing they did was stone, and sometimes they would take the corpse and burn it as an object lesson to the people who saw it and as a thing of dishonor for the family. Could be that they were just supposed to let him die by the immediate hand of God and wait for God to kill him, but no, I don't think so. They had to be responsible and do their judicial duty. So they had some decision to make. It's pretty clear the guy was going to die. How they're going to do it, I don't know. It could be that they were reluctant to execute him because the law didn't specifically say that he was to die. The law just said he would not go unpunished. It doesn't specifically say that you've blasphemed God, you are punished. You could reason from Exodus 21:17, the curser of a father or mother shall be put to death, but that's a reasoning, and maybe that reasoning's not good, and maybe we better talk to Moses about this. Of course, we don't need to lose sight of the fact that it might be whether they should execute or effect any punishment on the blasphemer at all because he was an alien. That might have been the judicial principle at stake here. Do we have jurisdiction over this guy because he's an alien? And of course, the answer to that is yes, you do. You treat the alien just like you treat the Israelite. We go now to Leviticus 24, verses 13 through 16. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, bring the one who is cursed outside the camp, and let all who heard him lay their hands on his head, then let all the congregation stone him. You shall speak to the sons of Israel, saying, if anyone curses his God, then he will bear his sin. Moreover, the one who blasphemes the name of the Lord shall surely be put to death. All the congregation shall certainly stone him, the alien as well as the native. When he blasphemes the name, shall be put to death. This is all the negative way of saying the first line of the Lord's Prayer, which is the positive way of saying it. Hallowed or holy be your name. God, your name is holy. And the punishment here was, hey, you're going to die if you blaspheme God's name. It was done outside the camp. God told Moses to take him outside the camp. This is typical. Executions were always done outside the camp. I've got 5 verses in Deuteronomy which show that, which I won't read to you. Now, the people who heard the blasphemy laid their hands on his head. Now, this is interesting. What the hearers of the blasphemy are doing is, hey, we heard that blasphemy, that sin, that horrible sin, and we've been polluted by it. So we're going to take our pollution and the filth of what you did, and we're going to put it on your head, and you get out of here. You get outside the camp and get executed. We're free of it. We, the public of Israel, have nothing to do with you. May your guilt be upon your head, not ours. So there was a lot of symbolism there. In verse 14, all the congregation will stone the blasphemer. That means all the great men of Israel. Of course, it would be physically impossible for the whole congregation of Israel to do this. We go now to Leviticus 24, verses 17 through 21. If a man takes the life of any human being, he shall surely be put to death. Now we're switching topics again. Now we're going to go to the Lex Talionis, the eye for an eye legal principle of punishment. Verse 17, if a man takes the life of any human being, he shall surely be put to death. The one who takes the life of an animal shall make it good, life for life. If a man injures his neighbor, just as he has done, so shall it be done to him. Fracture for fracture, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, just as he has injured a man, so it shall be inflicted on him. Thus the one who kills an animal shall make it good, but the one who kills a man shall be put to death. Now the first obvious question is, what is this eye for an eye principle put right in the middle of the story of the blasphemer? Adam Clark says it's to show that blasphemy against God is every bit as serious as killing a human being. Because the blasphemer dies, the murderer dies. Sort of an equivalence there. You don't shake your fist in God's face. You don't do that. God is holy. Hallowed be thy name. Holy be thy name. Now, verse 17 says, if any man takes the life of any human being, he shall be surely put to death. And one might say, well, yeah, that's under the law, but we're not under the Mosaic law today, so that's not an argument for capital punishment. And I would agree with your reasoning perfectly, except for one thing. Capital punishment was instituted before the law, and it was also after the law. Before the law, Genesis 9:6, whoever shed man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed, for in the image of God he made man. In other words, you kill an image bearer of God, that's a serious business, buddy. You have touched God because this man shared God's image. And so that's serious, and you're going to die for that. Exodus 21:12, he who strikes a man so that he dies shall surely be put to death. So capital punishment is before the law in Genesis 9:6. Exodus 21:12, that's enduring the law, just like this in Leviticus. And also Romans, after the law, in Romans 13, God gave the government the power of the sword to inflict punishment on evildoers, and of course a sword is not for playing tiddlywinks with, it's for executions. Verse 18 says, the one who takes the life of an animal shall make it good. There's no mention of the 20% restitution penalty that we see in trespass offerings, guilt offerings. It's not mentioned, but I'm sure it was so obvious it didn't need to be mentioned. I'm sure there was a 20% penalty added here. The point is you make restitution to cover the damage. Eye for an eye, tooth for tooth. Verse 19, if a man injures his neighbor just as he has done, shall it be done to him. Restitution. Now, when it says, so it shall be done to him, that of course does not mean the same literal injury is done to the offender. It means the offender must pay the value of the damage measured in terms of money. For example, I put out the eye of somebody in a fight. And so I go to court and the judge says, okay, he's going to put your eye out too. That's not what it means. It means what's the value of an eye? We still do that in modern day law. Insurance tables have values of an arm, a leg, an ear, and an eye. And if somebody injures one of those things or even has it put out in a fight, there's your damages right there, what it's worth. Of course, a lot of times the damages have to be litigated, but never is the penalty the exact literal same thing as the offense. That would be absurd. This eye for an eye scripture, the principle of Lex Talionis, the law of retaliation. It's found in Exodus 21, 24 through 25, and in Deuteronomy 19, 21. Exodus 21, 24 and 25, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, bruise for bruise, which is just an elaborate way of saying just compensation, folks. You don't give him more damages than the damage was done, except maybe for the 20%. Deuteronomy 19:21, thus you shall not show pity, life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. Showing pity there, it sounds like that's bad, but what it means is don't let somebody off lightly and not make him give recompense to his injured neighbor. Now, I've said this before, I'll say it again, it's not to be taken literally. It was meant to state a basic judicial principle. The penalty is to fit the crime and not to exceed it. There's no evidence that the penalty was ever literally enacted. John Gill gives an excellent example of how that could, in this example, affect injustice. Let's say there was an offender with one eye, and he puts out the eye of a two-eyed victim. Well, now we've eye for an eye, so we literally have to take out the offender's eye. Well, now, if you take out his last eye, he will be completely blind, in which case he'll be worse off than the one he victimized, who's only partially blind. Another example, how can the judges burn and wound someone exactly as the victim? Burn for burn, wound for wound. That's impossible, especially when individuals react to wounds differently. A sensitive sort of person might die if you burn him in the same way, so that in which case the punishment will be worse than the crime. This idea of eye for eye and tooth for tooth is found in the Babylonian Code of Hammurabi, which is in the Louvre Museum, and it also seems not to have been literally applied, as the NIV Study Bible points out. Now, of course, we all know how Jesus quoted this eye for an eye verse, or one of these three verses where it's mentioned in the Old Testament law. He did so in the Sermon on the Mount. Matthew 5:38-42, you have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist an evil person, but whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn the other to him also. If anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, let him have your coat also. Whoever forces you to go 1 mile, go with him 2. Give to him who asks of you, and do not turn away from him who wants to borrow from you. And we're all familiar with that. Ladies and gentlemen, Jesus was not trying to overthrow this principle of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. What he was doing was, he was objecting to the Pharisaical misuse of that law, because they said, oh, you hurt me, well, I have the right to go after you in a private matter of revenge, not going to court. You know, if somebody puts my eye out, I've got a right to take him to court and get money damages for it plus 20%, if it can be determined. I've got a right to do that. But I don't have the right to say, oh, you took my eye out, well, I'm coming after you, buddy, and I'm going to take your eye out. You can't do that. That's anarchy. And so the Pharisees were saying, hey, private revenge is perfectly all right. Just go get the guy. And Jesus is saying, no, private revenge is not all right. He was not trying to overturn the law courts, which, of course, would have been absurd and lead to anarchy. Now, in verse 21, we see this idea of capital punishment for humans repeated for animals. Verse 21, the one who kills an animal shall make it good. Actually, that was also stated in verse 18. It's repeated for emphasis. Or maybe to contrast the last part of verse 21, the one who kills a man should be put to death. You kill an animal, you replace the animal. But the problem with killing a human being, you can't replace him. For example, I kill Susie Q's husband, John Doe. So I go to Susie Q and says, gee, I'm so sorry, I'm guilty. I need to replace John Doe. I'll marry you. It just doesn't work that way. So there has to be capital punishment for the one who commits homicide. We go now to Leviticus chapter 24, verses 22 and 23. There shall be one standard for you. It shall be for the stranger as well as the native, for I am the Lord your God. Then Moses spoke to the sons of Israel, and they brought the one who had cursed outside the camp and stoned him with stones. Thus the sons of Israel did just as the Lord had commanded Moses. Now that phrase, just as the Lord had commanded Moses, is mentioned over and over again in the law. The idea, we're going to do exactly what God tells us to do, and we're not going to change it. One standard, that means one standard for the native Israelite and the sojourner amongst the Israelites who are not native Israelites, the aliens, both. Law applies for you too. Now he's stoned. I mentioned the stoning procedure several times going through here. I've got a quote from Clark, how the man was stoned is slightly different than what you normally hear. So let me read this. We are not to suppose that the culprit was exposed to the unbridled fury of the thousands of Israel. This would be brutality, not justice, for the very worst of tempers and passions might be produced and fostered by such a procedure. I'm reminded of what happened to Stephen in Acts chapter 7. I believe that was probably a kangaroo court or a kangaroo court execution. Continuing with Clark's quotation, the Jews themselves tell us that their manner of stoning was this. They brought the condemned person without the camp, because his crime had rendered him unclean, and whatever was unclean must be put without the camp. When they came within 4 cubits of the place of execution, that's 6 feet, they stripped the criminal. It was a man, leaving him nothing but a cloth about the waist. The place on which he was to be executed was elevated, and the witnesses went up with him to it, laid their hands upon him for the purposes mentioned in Leviticus, for the purposes mentioned, in other words, to kill him. Then one of the witnesses struck him with a stone upon the loins, and that to me is a little strange, because usually you take him up to an eminence, a hill, and you push him off a hill. And Clark doesn't mention that. And if he doesn't die at the bottom of a hill, then they drop the stones on his chest. Clark says if he was not killed with that blow, when he was struck with a stone, then the witnesses took up a great stone, such as two men could lift, and threw it upon his breast. He doesn't mention coming from off the hill. This was the coup de grace and finished the tragedy. Well, this incident established the stoning as the punishment for blasphemy, as illustrated by the New Testament case of Stephen, who was falsely accused of blasphemy and then stoned to death. Ladies and gentlemen, we have finished Leviticus chapter 24, and we are now ready to go to Leviticus 25, the first half of the chapter, 1 through 22. We'll talk about the Sabbath year and the year of Jubilee in our next audio. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.